the gulf and rattle in an increase of rain. Then Anne lifted her arms and folded them before her so that one of her hands was on each of mine.
"Jackie," she said in a low voice, which wasn't, however, a whisper. "Jackie Bird, I came up here."
She had come all right. I began to undo the hooks and eyes down the back of the white dress. She stood absolutely still, as though good and obedient, with a pigtail hanging back over each shoulder. The fact that the light cloth was damp and clingy didn't make things any easier. I kept fumbling the goddamned hooks and eyes. Then I came to the sash. It was tied in a bow on the left side, I remember. I got that free, and it fell to the floor, and I began again on the dress. She was as patient, standing there with her arms at her side, as though I were a dressmaker and she were having a fitting. She didn't say anything except when I, in my clumsiness and confusion, tried to pull the dress down over her hips.
"No," she said then, in the same low voice as before. "No, this way."
And lifted her bare arms above her head. I noticed even then that she didn't let the fingers fall loose in the natural way, but held them together on each hand and almost straight, as though she were lifting her arms for a dive and had stopped just before completing the preliminary posture. I drew the dress over her head and stood there with it clutched foolishly in my hands before I got the wit to lay it across a chair. She was standing with her arms still up, and I took that as a sign the slip was to come off the same way the dress had. It came off the same way, and with my clumsy, nervous meticulousness, I laid it across a chair, as though it might break. She lowered her arms to her sides and stood with the same passivity while I finished the task. While I unhooked the brassiere and lifted it forward so that it would fall down her motionless arms, and released the drawers and drew them down her legs, kneeling on the floor beside her, I was somehow so careful that my fingers never even brushed her skin. My breath was quick, and the constriction in my throat and chest was like a knot, but my mind kept flying off to peculiar things, to a book I'd started and never finished, to wondering whether I would go back to the dormitory that fall or take a room out, to an algebraic formula I remembered which kept running through my head, to a scene just the corner of a field with a broken stile which I tried desperately to locate out of my past. My mind would just take those crazy wild leaps and centrifugal plunges like an animal with one foot in a trap or a June bug on a string. As I crouched there beside her, just as I had let the batiste drop about her feet, she slipped one foot from its pump. You know how girls do, pressing the heels together a little so that the feet can be drawn out, then the other. I rose to stand beside her and experienced a kind of shock to find how small she was, standing flat on the floor without her heels. I'd seen her that way 1,000 times in a bathing suit, standing barefooted on the sand or float, but it struck me now. She stood there as I rose, with her arms hanging loose as before. Then she folded them across her breast and hunched her shoulders a little and gave a slight shiver, and I saw how with the drawing forward of the shoulder blades suddenly seemed sharp and frail, with a pigtail hanging down across each one. It was raining hard outside now with violent gusts. I noticed that. Her head was slightly inclined forward, and she apparently saw or remembered that she still had on her stockings. Turning from me a little, she leaned forward, and balancing herself on one foot and then the other, drew them off and let them fall with the sash and the little wispy pile of stuff there before her. Then she stood as before, hunched, slightly forward, perhaps shivering, her knees slightly bent and pressed together. While I stood there fumbling with the buttons on my shirt, tearing one loose because I couldn't seem to get it through the buttonhole, in a momentary lull of the wind and rain it made a slight tick when it struck the uncarpeted floor. And while my mind made the crazy June-bug leaps and plunges, she walked across to the iron bed and sat down, tentatively, close to the edge, her feet and knees pressed close, her arms still folded and her shoulders slightly hunched as before. She was looking up at me across the space with a question or appeal in her eyes. I couldn't read them in the dimness. Then, letting one hand drop to the bed for support, she leaned a little sideways, lifted her feet from the floor, still together, and with a gentle curling motion lay back on the white counterpane, then punctiliously straightened out and again folded her hands across her bosom and closed her eyes. And at the instant when she closed her eyes, as I stared at her,
My mind took one of the crazy leaps, and I saw her floating in the water, that day of the picnic 3 years before, with her eyes closed and the violent sky above and the white gull flashing high over. And that face and this face and that scene and this scene seemed to fuse, like superimposed photographs, each keeping its identity but without denying the other. And at that instant, as I stood there with the constriction in my throat that made me swallow hard, and with my body tumescent, I looked at her there on the iron bed, then looked suddenly around the big, bare, shadowy room, and heard the gusty rain, and knew that everything was wrong. Completely wrong. How, I didn't know, didn't try to know, and that this was, somehow, not what the summer had been driving toward, that I wasn't going to do it. "Anne," I said hoarsely. "Anne." She didn't answer, but she opened her eyes and looked at me. "We oughtn't," I began. "We oughtn't. It wouldn't be right. So I used the word right, which came to my lips to surprise me, for I hadn't ever thought of anything I had done with Anne Stanton or with any other woman or girl as being right or wrong, but as just something that happened, and hadn't ever thought about right or wrong very much in connection with anything, but had simply done the things people do and not done the things people don't do. Which are the things people do and don't do. And I remember now the surprise I felt when I heard that word there in the air, like the echo of a word spoken by somebody else God knows how many years before, and now unfrozen like a word in Baron Munchausen's tale. I couldn't any more have touched her then than if she had been my little sister. She didn't answer then, but kept on looking at me, with an expression I could not fathom. And as I looked at her, I was overwhelmed by a great warm pity, like a flood in my bosom, and burst out, "Anne! Oh, Anne!" and felt the impulse to fling myself to my knees beside the bed and seize her hand. Now, if I had done that, things might have developed differently and more in the normal pattern. For it's probable that when a half-clothed and healthy young man kneels beside a bed and seizes the hand of an entirely unclothed and good-looking young girl, developments will follow the normal pattern sooner or later. And if I had once touched her in the process of undressing her, or even if she had spoken to me to say anything, to call me Jackie Boy, or tell me she loved me, or had giggled or seemed gay, or had even answered me, saying anything whatsoever, when I looked at her lying there on the bed and first cried out her name, if any of those things had happened, things might have been different then and forever afterward. But none of those things had happened. And I was not to follow the wild impulse to throw myself on my knees by the bed and take her hand to make the first trifling contact of flesh with flesh, which would probably have been enough. For just as I burst out, "Anne, oh, Anne," there was a sound of tires on the drive, then the creaking of brakes. "They've come back, they've come back," I exclaimed, and Anne rose abruptly to a sitting position on the bed and looked wildly at me. "Grab your stuff," I ordered. "Grab your stuff and get to the bathroom. You could have been in the bathroom." I was cramming my shirt in and was trying to buckle my belt all at once and was going toward the door. "I'll be in the kitchen," I said. "I'll be fixing something to eat." Then I bolted from the room and ran down the hall, trying to run on tiptoe, and ran down the back stairs to the back passage and then into the kitchen, where I put a match to the gas under the coffee pot with trembling fingers, just as the front screen door slammed and people entered the hall. I sat down at the table and began to make sandwiches, waiting for my heart to stop pounding before I confronted my mother and the Pattons and whatever bastards they had with them. When my mother came on back to the kitchen, right away, followed by her gang, there I was, and there was a nice pile of toothsome sandwiches, and they weren't going to LaGrange because of the storm and kidded me about being a mind reader and having the sandwiches and coffee all ready for them, and I was charming and gracious to them all. Then Anne came down. She had done a good circumstantial job and flushed the toilet twice to advertise her whereabouts. And they kidded her about her pigtails and her pickaninny hair ribbons, and she didn't say anything but smiled shyly, the way a nice, well-bred young girl should when the grown-ups take amiable notice of her. And then she sat quietly and ate a sandwich, and I couldn't read a thing from her face, not a thing. Well, that was the way the summer ended. True, there was the rest of the night, with me lying on the iron bed and hearing the leaves drip and cursing myself for a fool and cursing my luck and trying to figure out what Anne had thought and trying to plan how I would get her off alone the next day, the last day. But then I would think how if I had gone on, it would have been worse, with my mother coming back and going upstairs with the ladies, as she had done, and with Anne and me trapped there in my room. And as that thought scared me into a cold sweat, I suddenly had the feeling of great wisdom. I had acted rightly and wisely. Therefore we had been saved. And so my luck became my wisdom, as the luck of the damned human race becomes its wisdom and gets into the books and is taught in schools. And then later my wisdom became my nobility, for in the end, a long time after, I got the notion that I had acted out of nobility. Not that I used that word to myself, but I skirted all around its edges and frequently, late at night or after a few drinks, thought better of myself for remembering my behavior on that occasion. And as my home movie unrolled, as I drove west, I could not help but reflect that if I hadn't been so noble, if it was nobility, everything would have been different. For certainly, if Anne and I had been trapped in that room, my mother and Governor Stanton would have set us up in matrimony, even if grimly and grudgingly. And then, whatever else might have happened, the thing that had happened to send me west would never have happened. So, I observed, my nobility, or whatever it was, had had in my world almost as dire a consequence as Cass Mastern's sin had had in his, which may tell something about the two worlds. There was, as I was saying, the rest of the night after Anne had gone home, but there was also the next day. Anne, however, was busy packing and doing errands in the landing during the day. I hung around her house and tried to talk with her, but we never got more than a few words together except when I drove her down to town. I tried to make her marry me right away, just to go home and get a bag and tear out. She was underage and all that, but I figured we could get by, insofar as I figured anything. Then let the governor and my mother raise hell. She only said, "Jackie boy, you know I'm going to marry you. Of course I'm going to marry you forever and ever, but not today." When I kept pestering her, she said, "You go on back to state and finish up, and I'll marry you, even before you get your law degree." When she said law degree, I didn't really remember right off what she was talking about, but I remembered in time not to express any surprise and had to be satisfied with that. I helped her with the errands, took her home, and then went to my house for dinner. After dinner, I went to see her early, going in the roadster with the hope, despite the lowering gusty weather, that we could take a ride, but it was no soap. Some of the boys and girls we'd played round with that summer were there to tell Anne goodbye, and some parents, two couples, were there too, to see the governor, who wasn't governor anymore, but to the landing would always be the governor, and give him a stirrup cup. The young people played a phonograph on the gallery, and the old people, who looked old to us anyway, sat inside and drank gin and tonic. The best I could do was to dance with Anne, who was sweet to me, but who, when I kept asking her to slip out with me, said she couldn't just then, she couldn't because of the guests, and she'd try to later. But then another storm blew up, for it was right at the equinox, and the parents came out to say they'd better go home and told their particular young ones in a loud voice that they ought to come too and let Anne get some sleep for the trip. I hung around, but it didn't do any good. Governor Stanton sat in the living room and had another drink by himself and looked over the evening paper. We clung together in the porch swing and listened to his paper rattle when he turned the page and whispered that we loved each other. Then we just clung without talking, for the words began to lose their meaning, and listened to the rain beat the trees. When a little break came in the rain, I got up, went inside, and shook hands with the governor, then came out, kissed Anne goodbye, and left. It was a stiff, cold-lipped kiss, as though the summer never had been at all, or hadn't been what it had been. I went on back to state. I felt that I couldn't wait for Christmas when she would come home. We wrote every day, but the letters began to seem like checks drawn on the summer's capital. There had been a lot in the bank, but it's never good business practice to live on your capital, and I had the feeling somehow of living on the capital and watching something dwindle. At the same time, I was wild to see her. I saw her Christmas for 10 days. It wasn't like the summer. She told me she loved me and was going to marry me, and she let me go pretty far. But she wouldn't marry me then, and she wouldn't go the limit. We had a row about that just before she left. She'd been willing to in September, but now she wouldn't. It seemed that she was, in a way, breaking a promise, and so I got pretty mad. I told her she didn't love me. She said she did. I wanted to know why she wouldn't go on then.
It's not because I'm afraid, and it's not because I don't love you. Oh, I do love you, Jackie, I do, she said. And it's not because I'm a nasty old nicey-pants. It's because you are the way you are, Jackie.
Yeah, I sneered. You mean you don't trust me? You think I wouldn't marry you, and then you'd be the ruined maid?
I know you'd marry me, she said. It's just because you're the way you are.
But she wouldn't say any more. So we had an awful row. I went back to state a nervous wreck. She didn't write to me for a month. I held out about 2 weeks and then began to apologize. So the letters began again, and far off, somewhere in the great bookkeeping system of the universe, somebody punched some red buttons every day on a posting machine and some red figures went on the ledger sheet. She was back at the landing in June for a few days, but the governor was not well, and before long the doctors packed him off to Maine to get him out of the heat. He took Anne with him. Before she left, it was just like Christmas, and not like the summer before. It was even worse than Christmas, for I had my B.A. now, and it was time for me to get into the law school. We had a row about that. Or was it about that? She said something about law, and I blew up. We made it up, by letter, after she'd been in Maine 6 weeks, and the letters began again, and the red figures fell like bloody little bird tracks on that ledger leaf bearing my name in the sky. And I lay around Judge Irwin's house and read American history, not for school, not because I had to, but because I had, by accident, stepped through the thin, crackly crust of the present and felt the first pull of the quicksand about my ankles. When she came back for a week or so in the fall with her father, before she went off to some refined female college in Virginia, we spent a lot of time in the bay and in the roadster and made all the motions we had made before. She flew down from the diving tower like a bird. She lay in my arms in the moonlight, when there was moonlight. But it was not the way it had been. For one thing, there was the incident of the new kiss. About the second or third time we were together that fall, she kissed me in a new way, a way she'd never used before. And she didn't do it in the discriminating, experimental way she had done things the summer before. She just did it, in the heat of the moment, you might say. I knew right away she'd picked it up from some man up in Maine that summer, some summer bastard in white flannel pants with vowels that clicked like dominoes. I told her I knew she'd been fooling with some fellows in Maine. She didn't deny it, not even for an instant. She just said, "Yes," as cool as could be, and asked me how I knew. I told her. Then she said, "Oh, of course." And I got pretty mad and pulled away from her. She'd kept her arm around my neck the whole time. She just looked at me, still cool, and said, "Jack, I did kiss a man up in Maine. He was a nice boy, Jack, and I liked him a lot, and he was fun to be with, but I didn't love him. And if you and I hadn't had that row, and I hadn't felt that the world had sort of come to an end, and I wouldn't be with you again, I wouldn't have done it. Maybe I wanted to fall in love with him, to fill up the empty place you left, Jackie. Oh, Jackie, there was a place, an awful big place." And with a simple, unthinking gesture, she laid her right hand on her heart. "But I couldn't," she said. "I couldn't fall in love with him. And I quit kissing him, even before we made up, you and I." She reached out and laid her right hand on one of my hands and leaned toward me. "For we did make up, you and I," she asked. "Didn't we, Jackie Bird?" She laughed a quick laugh that welled up in her throat, then asked, "Didn't we, Jackie boy? Didn't we? And I'm happy again." "Yeah," I said, "we did." "Aren't you happy?" she asked, leaning. "Sure," I said, and was as happy, I suppose, as I deserved to be. But the thing was there all the time, breathing back there in the dark of my mind and waiting to pounce, even though I forgot it was there. Then, the next night, when she didn't kiss me in the new way, I felt the thing stir. And the next night, because she didn't kiss me that new way, I was even angrier than I had been when she had. So I kissed her the way that man in Maine had done. She drew back from me immediately and said, quite quietly, I know why you did that.
You liked it well enough up in Maine, I said.
Oh, Jackie, she said. There isn't any place called Maine and never was. There just isn't anything but you, and you are all 48 states together, and I loved you all the time. Now will you be good and kiss me our way? So I did that. But the world is a great snowball rolling downhill, and it never rolls uphill to unwind itself back to nothing at all and non-happening. Even though the summer just passed had not been like the summer before, I went on to state again and got my job back, hashing, and did some newspaper reporting and entered the law school, and loathed it. Meanwhile, I wrote letters to Anne at the very refined female college in Virginia, and the capital on which those checks were drawn dwindled and dwindled. Till Christmas. When I came home and Anne came home, I told her I simply loathed the law school and expected, and in a twisted way wanted, hell to pop. But hell did not pop. She merely reached over and patted my hand. We were sitting on the couch in the Stanton living room, where we had clutched and clung until we had finally fallen apart from each other, she in a kind of withdrawn melancholy, and I in the fatigue and irritation of desire too long protracted and frustrated. She patted my hand and said, Well, don't study law, then. You don't have to study law. Well, what do you want me to do, then?
Jackie, I never wanted you to study law. It was your idea.
Oh, was it?
I asked.
Yes, she said, and patted my hand again. Do what you want to, Jackie. I want you to do what you want. And I don't care if you don't make money. I told you long back I'd live on red beans with you.
I got up from the couch. For one reason, so she couldn't pat my hand in that way, which suddenly reminded me of the way a nurse pats the hand of a patient, a sort of impersonal pat intended to be soothing. I stood well back from her and spoke firmly. All right, you'll eat red beans with me. Let's get married. Tomorrow, tonight. We fooled around long enough. You say you love me. All right, I love you. She didn't say anything, but sat there on the couch with her hands lying loose in her lap, and lifted her face, which suddenly was tired and drawn, and looked up at me from eyes which gradually brightened with unshed tears.
You do love me? I demanded.
She nodded slowly.
And you know I love you?
I demanded. She nodded again.
All right, then.
Jack, she said, then stopped for a moment. Jack, I do love you. I guess I feel sometimes that I might just kiss you and hold you tight and close my eyes and jump off a cliff with you. Or like that time when you dived down to me and we kissed in the water and it seemed like we'd never come up. Do you remember, Jack?
Yes, I said.
I loved you like that then, Jack.
Now? I demanded. What about now?
Now, too, Jack. I guess I could do it now, too, but it's different, too.
Different?
Oh, Jack, she exclaimed, and for the first time, at least the first time I ever remembered, made the gesture of lifting her hands to her temples, that gesture to control distraction, which was never to become characteristic, but which I was to see again. Oh, Jack, she said again, things have happened. So much has happened since then.
What has happened?
Oh, it's just that getting married isn't like jumping off a cliff. Love isn't either, isn't like jumping off a cliff. Or getting drowned. Oh, I don't know how to say it. It's trying to live. It's having a way to live.
Money, I said. If it's money, you...
It's not money, she interrupted. I don't mean money. Oh, Jack, if you only could see what I mean.
Well, I'm not going to get a job with Patton or anybody around here. Or have them get me a job, not even Irwin. I'll get a job, I don't care what kind, but not with them.
Darling, she said tiredly, I'm not trying to make you come here or get a job with Patton or anybody. I want you to do what you want, just so it is something. Even if you don't make money, I told you I'd live in a shack.
So I went back to the law school and by dint of consistent effort succeeded in busting out before the end of the year. It took a lot of attention to get busted out, for a man just can't achieve that by the ordinary means at state. He has to work at it. I could have simply resigned, of course, but if you simply drop out or resign, you might be able to come back. So I busted out. Then, while I was celebrating my busting out and was pretty sure Anne would be sore and throw me over, I got involved with a pal of mine and two girls, and there was a small scandal which got into the papers. I was an ex-student then, and so the university couldn't do anything about it. Anne didn't do anything either, for I guess I was an ex-Jackie Bird by that time. So Anne went her way and I went mine. My way was to work for a newspaper and hang around the lower part of the city and read books on American history. Finally, I was taking courses at the university again, just spare time at first, then seriously. I was entering the enchantments of the past. For a while, it looked as though Anne and I had made it up, but somehow a gear slipped and it was like before. I didn't finish the PhD, so I went back to the Chronicle, where I was a reporter and a damn good one. I even got married to Lois, who was damn good-looking, a lot better-looking, I suppose, than Anne, and juicy, while Anne was inclined to bone and muscle under flesh. Lois looked edible, and you knew it was tender all the way through, a kind of mystic combination of filet mignon and a Georgia peach aching for the tongue and ready to bleed gold. Lois married me for reasons best known to herself. But one was, I am sure, that my name was Burden. I'm forced to this conclusion by the process of elimination. It could not have been my beauty, grace, charm, wit, intellect, and learning, for, in the first place, my beauty, grace, and charm were not great, and in the second place, Lois didn't have the slightest interest in wit, intellect, and learning, even if I had had them. It could not have been my mother's money, for Lois's own widowed mother had plenty of money, which Lois's father had made from a lucky war contract for gravel, a little too late to give those things called advantages to his daughter at her most impressionable age. So it must have been the name of Burden. Unless it was that Lois was in love with me. I put this possibility in the list merely for logical and schematic completeness, for I'm quite sure that the only things Lois knew about love was how to spell the word and how to make the physiological adjustments traditionally associated with the idea. She did not spell very well, but she made those adjustments with great skill and relish. The relish was nature, but the skill was art, and ars longa est. I knew this, despite the very expert and sustained histrionics of which Lois was capable. I knew it, but I succeeded in burying it out in the backyard of my mind, like a rat that has been caught in the pantry gnawing the cheese. I didn't really care, I suppose, so long as nothing happened to make me have to face the fact. And once in my arms, Mrs. Burden was very faithful or very discreet, for nothing ever happened, and the arrangement was perfect. "Jack and I are perfectly adjusted sexually," Lois used to say primly, for she was very advanced in what with her passed for thought, and was very sophisticated in her language. She would look around at the faces of the guests in the very slick, modernistic apartment. Her taste ran that way and not to balconies overlooking charming old patios, and her money paid the rent, and would tell them how perfectly adjusted she and I were, and in telling them would add about 2 extra chocolate cream puff syllables to the word sexually. For a while, I didn't mind her telling the guests about how well-adjusted we were. It even flattered my ego, for nobody would mind having his name coupled with that of Lois, or having his picture taken with her in a public place. So I would beam modestly around the little group, while Lois told them about that perfect adjustment. But later it began to annoy me. As long as I regarded Lois as a beautiful, juicy, soft, vibrant, sweet-smelling, sweet-breathed machine for provoking and satisfying the appetite, and that was the Lois I had married, all was well. But as soon as I began to regard her as a person, trouble began. All would have been well, perhaps, had Lois been struck dumb at puberty. Then no man could have withstood her, but she could talk. And when something talks, you sooner or later begin to listen to the sound it makes and begin, even in the face of all other evidence, to regard it as a person.
You begin to apply human standards to it, and the human element infects your innocent Eden pleasure in the juicy, sweet-breathed machine. I had loved Lois the machine the way you love the filet mignon or the Georgia peach, but I definitely was not in love with Lois the person. In fact, as the realization grew that the machine Lois belonged to and was the instrument of the person Lois, or at least to the thing which could talk, the machine Lois, which I had innocently loved, began to resemble a beautiful, luscious bivalve, open and pulsing in the glimmering deep, and I, some small speck of marine life being drawn remorselessly. Or it resembled the butt of wine in which the Duke was drowned, and I was sure God the Duke of Clarence. Or it resembled a greedy, avid, delicious quagmire which would swallow up the lost, benighted traveler with a last, tired, liquid, contented sigh. Yes, in that greedy, delicious quagmire, the solemn temples, the gorgeous palaces, towers, battlements, libraries, museums, huts, hospitals, houses, cities, and all the works of man might be swallowed up with that last, luxurious sigh. Or so, I recall, it seemed. But the paradox is that as long as Lois was merely the machine Lois, as long as she was simply a well-dressed animal, as long as she was really a part of innocent, non-human nature, as long as I hadn't begun to notice that the sounds she made were words, there was no harm in her, and no harm in the really extraordinary pleasure she could provide. It was only when I observed that this Lois was mixed up with the other Lois, with certain human traits, that I began to feel that all the works of man might be swallowed up in the quagmire. It's a delicate paradox. I didn't make a decision not to be swallowed up. The instinct for self-preservation is more deep-seated than decision. A man doesn't make a decision to swim when he falls into the creek. He starts kicking. I simply began to wriggle and squirm and kick. First, I recall, there was the matter of Lois's friends. No friends of mine ever set foot in the slick apartment. If, as a matter of fact, the people I knew in the city room and the speakeasy and the press club could be called friends. I began to take a distaste to the friends Lois had. There was nothing particularly wrong with them. They were just the ordinary garden variety of human garbage. There were some who had what Lois, who was not too well informed on the subject, regarded as position, but who didn't have much money and liked Lois's free liquor. There were some who didn't have any position, but who had more money than Lois and knew which fork to use. And there were some who didn't have very much of either position or money, but who had some credit at the better clothing stores and who could be bullied by Lois. They all read Vanity Fair or Harper's Bazaar, according to sex, and some read both, and Smart Set. And they quoted Dorothy Parker, and those who had been merely to Chicago licked the spittle of those who had been to New York, and those who had been merely to New York licked the spittle of those who had been to Paris. As I say, there was nothing particularly wrong with those people, many of whom were quite agreeable and attractive. The only thing I found wrong with them, I admit as I look back, was that they were Lois's friends. First, I developed a certain reserve in my dealings with them. Then I developed an attitude which Lois defined as snotty. After one of my exhibitions, Lois would try to discipline me by withholding the sweets of her gender. That was the matter of Lois's friends, but there was, second, the matter of Lois's apartment. I took a distaste for the apartment. I told Lois I didn't want to live there, that we would get a place on which I could afford to pay the rent out of my salary. We had some rows on that point, rows which I didn't expect to win. Then the sweets would be withheld. That was the matter of the apartment, but there was, third, the matter of my clothes and what Lois loved to call my grooming. I was accustomed to $30 suits, shirts that had been worn 2 days, a bi-monthly haircut, unpolished shoes, a hat with a brim that looped and sagged, and fingernails always broken and sometimes dirty. And I regarded the habit of pressing pants as something which had not come to stay. In the early days, when I looked on Lois as merely the luscious machine, I had allowed certain scarcely perceptible changes to be made in my appearance. But as I began to realize that the noises she made with her mouth resembled human speech, and were more than rudimentary demands for, or expressions of gratification at, food or copulation, a certain resistance began to grow in me.
and as the pressure to improve my grooming increased, so the resistance increased too. More and more often, accustomed objects of my wardrobe disappeared, to be replaced by proclaimed or surreptitious gifts. Originally, I had interpreted these gifts as springing from a misguided and love-inspired attempt to give me pleasure. In the end, I understood that my pleasure was the last consideration involved. The crisis came when I polished a shoe with a new tie. A row ensued, the first of many occasioned by the divergence of our tastes in haberdashery, and the sweets would be withheld on that count. They were withheld on many counts, but never for very long at a stretch. Sometimes I would capitulate and apologize. My early apologies were sometimes sad and, for the moment, even sincere, though sometimes sincere with a kind of self-pity. Then later they became masterpieces of irony, double entendre, and histrionics, and I would lie in bed, uttering them, aware that my face in the dark was twisted into a mask of self-congratulatory cunning, bitterness, and loathing. But I wasn't always the one to crack first, for sometimes the juicy machine Lois got the upper hand over the dry and brittle person Lois. She might utter an invitation in a low voice, tense with hatred, and then, in the subsequent process, avert her face from me, or if she did look at me, she would glare like a cornered animal. Or if she did not invite me, she might collapse in the heat of a scuffle which she had undertaken against me in all seriousness, but which had proved too much for the dry and brittle person Lois, and had given the other Lois the upper hand. In any case, whether she cracked or I, we demonstrated, in the midst of tangled bedclothes, unspoken loathing, and the wreckage of somebody's self-respect, that we were, as Lois had affirmed to her guests, perfectly adjusted sexually. And we were. The fact that the adjustment was so perfect merely meant that in the end, with the deep-seated instinct for self-preservation, I was consorting with common whores. I was at that time on the evening edition and finished my stint about 2 p.m. After a couple of drinks and a late lunch in a speakeasy, then a couple of more drinks and a game of billiards at the press club, I might call on one of my friends. Then at dinner, if I managed to get home to dinner, and in the evening, I would study Lois with a clinical detachment and a sense of mystic regeneration. It even got so that almost at will I could produce an optical illusion. I could look at Lois in a certain way and find that she seemed to be withdrawing steadily, the whole room elongating with her, until it would be as though I were staring at her through the wrong end of a pair of binoculars. By this practice, I gained great spiritual refreshment. I finally grew so adept at it that I could hear her voice, if it was one of her vituperative and not sullen evenings, as though it were coming from a great distance and were not, as a matter of fact, even addressed to me. Then came the final phase, the phase of the great sleep. Immediately after dinner, every evening, I went to bed and slept soundly, with the sweet feeling of ever falling toward the center of delicious blackness, until the last possible moment the next morning. Sometimes I didn't even wait for dinner and the pleasure of observing Lois. I would just go to bed. I remember that this became almost a habit in the late spring. I would come in from my afternoon's occupation and draw the shade in the bedroom and go to bed, with the mild light oozing in from around the shade and birds twittering and caroling in the trees of the little park next to the apartment building and children calling musically from the playground in the park. Going to bed in the late spring afternoon or just at the beginning of twilight with those sounds in your ears gives you a wonderful sense of peace, a peace which must resemble the peace of old age after a well-spent life. But, of course, there was Lois. Sometimes she would come into my bedroom, by this time I had moved into the guest room for my serious sleeping, and sit on the edge of the bed and give me long descriptions of myself, rather monotonous descriptions, as a matter of fact, for Lois had little gift of phrase and had to fall back on the 3 or 4 classic terms. Sometimes she would beat me with her clenched fists. She had a feeble female way of using her little white fists. I could sleep through the descriptions and almost through the beating of the clenched fists on my side or back. Sometimes she would cry and give vent to a great deal of self-pity. Once or twice she even snuggled into bed with me. Sometimes she would open the door to my room and turn up the phonograph in the living room until the joint shook. But no soap. I could sleep through anything, or just about. Then the morning came when I opened my eyes and felt the finger of fate upon me. I knew the time had come. I got up and packed my suitcase and walked out the door and didn't come back. To the slick apartment, and to Lois, who was beautiful, and to whom I was so perfectly adjusted. I never saw her again, but I know what she looks like now when cocktails, bonbons, late hours, and nearly 40 years have done their work on the peach bloom of cheeks, the pearly, ripe but vigorous bosom, the supple midriff, the brooding, black, velvety, liquid eyes, the bee-stung lips, the luxurious thighs. She sits on a divan somewhere, held more or less in shape by the vigor of a masseuse and the bands of lastex which secretly sheath her like a mummy, but bloated with the entire universe she has ingurgitated with a long, delicious sigh. And now, with a hand on which the pointed nails are as red as though she had just used them to rip greedily the guts from a yet living sacrificial fowl, she reaches out to a silver dish to pick up a chocolate. And while the chocolate is yet mid-air, the lower lip drops open, and beyond the purplish tint of the microscopically scaling veneer of lipstick, one sees the damp, paler red expectant membranes of the mouth, and the faint glitter of a gold filling in the dark, hot orifice. Goodbye, Lois, and I forgive you for everything I did to you. As for the way Anne Stanton went, meanwhile, the story is short. After 2 years at the refined female college in Virginia, she came home. Adam, by this time, was in medical school up east. Anne spent a year going to parties in the city and got engaged, but nothing came of it. He was a decent, intelligent, prosperous fellow, too. After a while, there was another engagement, but something happened again. By this time, Governor Stanton was nearly an invalid, and Adam was studying abroad. Anne quit going to parties, except an occasional party at the Landing in the summer. She stayed at home with her father, giving him his medicine, patting his pillow, assisting the nurse, reading to him hour by hour, holding his hand in the summer twilights or in the winter evenings when the house shook to the blasts off the sea. It took him 7 years to die. After the governor had died in the big tester bed with a lot of expensive medical talent leaning over him, Anne Stanton lived in the house fronting the sea, with only the company of Aunt Sophonisba, a feeble, grumbling, garrulous, and incompetent old colored woman, who combined benevolence and a vengeful tyranny in the ambiguous way known only to old colored women who have spent their lives in affectionate service, in prying, wheedling, and chicanery, in short-lived rebelliousness and long irony, and in second-hand clothes. Then Aunt Sophonisba died, too, and Adam came back from abroad, loaded with academic distinctions and fanatically devoted to his work. Shortly after his return, Anne moved to the city to be near him. By this time, she was pushing 30. She lived alone in a small apartment in the city. Occasionally, she had lunch with some woman who had been a friend of her girlhood, but who now inhabited another world. Occasionally, she went to a party, at the house of one of the women or at the country club. She became engaged for a third time, this time to a man 17 or 18 years older than she, a widower with several children, a substantial lawyer, a pillar of society. He was a good man. He was still vigorous and rather handsome. He even had a sense of humor. But she didn't marry him. More and more, as the years passed, she devoted herself to sporadic reading, biography, Daniel Boone or Marie Antoinette, what is called good fiction, books on social betterment, and to work without pay for a settlement house and an orphanage. She kept her looks very well and continued in a rather severe way to pay attention to her dress. There were moments now when her laugh sounded a little hollow and brittle, the laughter of nerves, not of mirth or good spirits. Occasionally, in a conversation, she seemed to lose track and fall into a self-absorption, to start up overwhelmed by embarrassment and unspoken remorse. Occasionally, too, she practiced the gesture of lifting her hands to her brow, one on each side, the fingers just touching the skin, or lifting back the hair, the gesture of a delicate distraction. She was pushing 35. But she could still be good company. That was the Anne Stanton whom Willie Stark had picked out, who had finally betrayed me, or rather, had betrayed an idea of mine which had had more importance for me than I had ever realized. That was why I had got into my car and headed west, because when you don't like it where you are, you always go west. We have always gone west. That was why I drowned in west and relived my life like a home movie. That was why I came to lie on a bed in a hotel in Long Beach, California, on the last coast amid the grandeurs of nature. For that's where you come, after you've crossed oceans and eaten stale biscuits while prisoned 40 days and nights in a storm-tossed rat-trap, after you've sweated in the greenery and heard the savage whoop, after you've built cabins and cities and bridged rivers, after you've lain with women and scattered children like millet seed in a high wind, after you've composed resonant documents, made noble speeches, and bathed your arms in blood to the elbows, after you've shaken with malaria in the marshes and in the icy wind across the high plains. That's where you come, to lie alone on a bed in a hotel room in Long Beach, California. Where I lay, while outside my window a neon sign flickered on and off to the time of my heart, systole and diastole, flushing and flushing again the gray sea mist with a tint like blood. I lay there, having drowned in west, my body having drifted down to lie there in the comforting subliminal ooze on the sea floor of history. Lying there, I had what I thought then was a fine perspective on my own history, and saw that the girl I had known that summer a long time back hadn't been beautiful and charming, but had merely been smooth-faced and healthy. And though she had sung songs to Jackie Bird while she cradled his head on her breast, she hadn't loved him, but had merely had a mysterious itch in the blood, and he was handy, and the word love was a word for the mysterious itch. And that she had been tormented by the mysterious itch, and torn between its impulse and fear, and that all her withholdments and hesitations had not been prompted by some dream of making love mean something, and making me understand that dream, but that they had been prompted by all the fears which the leaning, sibilant, sour-breathed old dough-faces of conventional society had whispered into her ear like fairy godmothers while she lay in her cradle, and that those withholdments and hesitations were no better or worse than the hottest surrender, nor better or worse than those withholdments practiced by Lois for other ends. And in the end you could not tell Anne Stanton from Lois Seeger, for they were alike, and though the mad poet William Blake wrote a poem to tell the adversary, who is prince of this world, that he could not ever change Kate into Nan, the mad poet was quite wrong, for anybody could change Kate into Nan, or if indeed the prince couldn't change Kate into Nan, it was only because Kate and Nan were exactly alike to begin with, and were, in fact, the same, with only the illusory difference of name, which meant nothing. For names meant nothing, and all the words we speak meant nothing, and there was only the pulse in the blood, and the twitch of the nerve, like a dead frog's leg in the experiment when the electric current goes through. So when I lay there on the bed in Long Beach, and shut my eyes, I saw in the inward darkness, as in mire, the vast heave and contortion of numberless bodies, and limbs detached from bodies, sweating and perhaps bleeding from inexhaustible wounds. But finally this spectacle, which I could summon up by the mere act of closing my eyes, seemed merely funny to me. So I laughed out loud. I laughed out loud, and then after watching for some time the rhythmic flushing of the sea mist by the neon sign, I went to sleep. When I woke up, I made ready to go back to the place and the things I had come from. Years before, a young girl had lain there naked on the iron bed in my room, with her eyes closed and her hands folded over her breast. And I had been so struck by the pathos of her submissiveness, and her trust in me, and of the moment which would plunge her into the full, dark stream of the world, that I had hesitated before laying my hands upon her, and had, without understanding myself, called out her name. At that time I had had no words for what I felt, and now, too, it's difficult to find them. But lying there, she had seemed to be again the little girl who had, on the day of the picnic, floated on the waters of the bay, with her eyes closed under the stormy and grape-purple sky and the single white gull passing over very high. As she lay there, the image came into my head, and I had wanted to call her name to tell her something, what I did not know. She trusted me, but perhaps for that moment of hesitation I did not trust myself, and looked back upon the past as something precious about to be snatched away from us and was afraid of the future. I had not understood then what I think I have now come to understand, that we can keep the past only by having the future, for they are forever tied together. Therefore I lacked some essential confidence in the world and in myself. She came, as time passed, to suspect this fact about me. I don't know that she had words to describe the fact to herself, or she only had the easy words people gave her, wanting to have a job, studying law, doing something. We went different ways in the world, as I have said, but I had with me always that image of the little girl on the waters of the bay, all innocence and trustfulness under the stormy sky. Then there came the day when that image was taken from me. I learned that Anne Stanton had become the mistress of Willie Stark, that somehow by an obscure and necessary logic I had handed her over to him. That fact was too horrible to face, for it robbed me of something out of the past by which, unwittingly until that moment, I had been living. So I fled west from the fact, and in the west, at the end of history, the last man on that last coast, on my hotel bed, I had discovered the dream. That dream was the dream that all life is but the dark heave of blood and the twitch of the nerve. When you flee as far as you can flee, you will always find that dream, which is the dream of our age. At first it's always a nightmare and horrible, but in the end it may be, in a special way, rather bracing and tonic. At least it was so for me for a certain time. It was bracing because after the dream I felt that, in a way, Anne Stanton did not exist. The words Anne Stanton were simply a name for a peculiarly complicated piece of mechanism, which should mean nothing whatsoever to Jack Burden, who himself was simply another rather complicated piece of mechanism. At that time, when I first discovered that view of things, really discovered in my own way and not from any book, I felt that I had discovered the secret source of all strength and all endurance. That dream solves all problems. At first it was, as I have said, rather bracing and tonic. For after the dream, there's no reason why you should not go back and face the fact which you have fled from, even if the fact seems to be that you have, by digging up the truth about the past, handed over Anne Stanton to Willie Stark. For any place to which you may flee will now be like the place from which you have fled, and you might as well go back, after all, to the place where you belong, for nothing was your fault or anybody's fault, for things are always as they are. And you can go back in good spirits, for you will have learned two very great truths. First, that you cannot lose what you have never had. Second, that you are never guilty of a crime which you did not commit. So there is innocence and a new start in the West, after all. If you believe the dream you dream when you go there. Chapter 8. So having lain on the bed in Long Beach, California, and seen what I had seen, I rose, much refreshed, and headed back with the morning sun in my face. It threw in my direction the shadows of white or pink or baby blue stucco bungalows, Spanish Mission, Moorish, or American cute in style, the shadows of filling stations resembling the gingerbread house of fairy tale, or Anne Hathaway's cottage or an Eskimo igloo, the shadows of palaces gleaming on hills among the arrogant traceries of eucalyptus, the shadows of leonine hunched mountains, the shadow of a boxcar forgotten on a lonely siding, and the shadow of a man walking toward me on a white road out of the distance which glittered like quartz. It threw the beautiful purple shadow of the whole world in my direction as I headed back, but I kept right on going at high speed, for if you've really been to Long Beach, California, and have had your dream on the hotel bed, then there's no reason why you should not return with a new confidence to wherever you came from, for now you know, and knowledge is power. You can put your throttle to the floor and let the 60-horsepower mystery whine like a wolfhound straining on leash. I passed the man who was walking toward me, and his face whirled away like a scrap of paper in a gale or boyhood hopes, and I laughed out loud. I saw the people walking in the plaza of little towns in the desert. I saw the waitress in the restaurant wave in feeble protest at the fly, while the electric fan needled the air, which was as thin and hot as the breath of a blast furnace. I saw the traveling salesman who stood at the hotel desk just ahead of me and said, "You call this a hotel, bud, and me wiring for a room and bath and you ain't held it? It's a wonder you got a room and bath in a burg like this." I saw the sheepherder standing alone on an enormous mesa. I saw the Indian woman with eyes the color of blackstrap molasses looking at me over a pile of pottery decorated with the tribal symbols of life and fertility and eminently designed for the 5- and 10-cent store trade. As I looked at all these people, I felt great strength in my secret knowledge. I remembered how once, long back when Willie Stark had been the dummy and the sap, at the time when he was Cousin Willie from the country and was running for governor the first time, I had gone over to the flea-bitten west part of the state to cover the barbecue and speaking at Upton. I'd gone on the local, which had yawed and puffed for hours across the cotton fields and then across the sagebrush. At one little town where it stopped, I'd looked out of the window and thought how the board or wire fences around the little board houses were inadequate to keep out the openness of the humped and sage-furred country, which seemed ready to slide in and eat up the houses. I had thought how the houses didn't look as though they belonged there, improvised, flung down, ready to be abandoned, with the scraps of washing still on the line, for there wouldn't be time to grab it off when the people finally realized that they had to go and go quick. I had had that thought, but just as the train was pulling out, a woman had come to the back door of one of the nearest houses to fling out a pan of water. She flings the water out, then looks a moment at the train drawing away, then deliberately enters the house. She's not going to run away. She's going into the house to some secret which is there, some knowledge. And as the train pulled away, I had had the notion that I was the one running away, and had better run fast, for it was going to be dark soon. I had thought of that woman as having a secret knowledge and had envied her. I had often envied people. People I'd seen fleetingly, or some people I had known a long time, a man driving a long straight furrow across a black field in April, or Adam Stanton. I had at moments envied the people who seemed to have a secret knowledge. But now as I whirled eastward over desert, under the shadow of mountains, by mesas across plateaus, and saw the people in that magnificent empty country, I didn't think that I would ever have to envy anybody again, for I was sure that now I had the secret knowledge, and with knowledge you can face up to anything, for knowledge is power. In a settlement named Don John, New Mexico, I talked to a man propped against the shady side of the filling station, enjoying the only patch of shade in 100 miles due east. He was an old fellow, 75 if a day, with a face like sun-brittled leather and pale blue eyes under the brim of a felt hat which had once been black. The only thing remarkable about him was the fact that while you looked into the sun-brittled leather of the face, which seemed as stiff and devitalized as the hide on a mummy's jaw, you would suddenly see a twitch in the left cheek up toward the pale blue eye. You would think he was going to wink, but he wasn't going to wink. The twitch was simply an independent phenomenon, unrelated to the face, or to what was behind the face, or to anything in the whole tissue of phenomena which is the world we are lost in. It was remarkable, in that face, the twitch which lived that little life all its own. I squatted by his side where he sat on a bundle of rags from which the handle of a tin skillet protruded, and listened to him talk. But the words were not alive. What was alive was the twitch, of which he was no longer aware. After my tank had been filled, I continued to watch that twitch, with glances stolen from the highway as we sat side by side in the car and hurtled eastward. He was going east too, going back. That was back in the days when the dust storms were blowing half the country away and folks headed west like the lemmings on a rampage. Only the folks who got there lacked the fine ecstasy of the lemmings. They didn't start swimming in teeming, obsessed hordes straight out to the middle of the blue Pacific. That would have been the logical thing for them to do. Just start swimming, Pa and Ma, Grandpa and Grandma, and Baby Rosebud with the running sore on her little chin, the whole kit and caboodle of them, flailing the water to a froth and heading out. But no, they were not like the lemmings, and so they just sat down and starved slowly in California.